Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey, and I'm the pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grays Lake, Illinois. Delighted to be back with you today. We have a great topics lined up and also a great panel. Let me introduce to you first a regular we have with us, Adam York, who's crossing paths. He's usually with us on Proclaiming Christ, but he's joining us today once again on Christ the Center. Adam serves as the pastor of Providence Presbyterian Church in Kingwood, Texas, just outside of Houston. Welcome back to the program, Adam. It's good to speak with you today.
Well, it's certainly a pleasure to be here today with you, Camden.
Yeah, well, today we're excited to welcome back to the program as well our special guest. We have Dr. William Edgar, who serves as professor of apologetics and the John Boyer Chair of Evangelism and Culture at Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia. Welcome back, Dr. Edgar. It's good to have you again.
Thank you, Camden. It's good to be with you, both of you.
Well, today we're going to be speaking about an important history, an important part of Reformed tradition, but one that doesn't receive as much attention as it ought to, at least in the American context. We're going to be speaking about the Reformation as it affected France, and we're going to be speaking specifically about the Huguenots and about their history and about their legacy. Now, Dr. Edgar also serves as the president of a nonprofit organization, which is known as the Huguenot Fellowship, and they have a bunch of important work that we're going to speak about as well and connect that to the modern day and to the history and legacy of these important reformers back in 16th century France. But before we get into our subject matter, we do have a few things to mention regarding Reformed Forum. The first is that we are listener-supported. We rely on all the generous support of our listeners and viewers to help us produce and distribute all of our programs free of charge. Just this last week, I was in Nashville, Tennessee, visiting some friends, a good friend, David Filson, who helps out and serves on East of Eden, and he also comes on Christ the Center. And I got to meet several people at his church at Christ Pres there in Nashville. It was a wonderful joy and pleasure. And it's just a great reminder to see how Reformed Forum's ministry and all of our recordings go out all over the country. But we also have people listening all over the world. So it's exciting. It's wonderful to hear. And it's wonderful that our materials are out there making a difference and helping people learn and grow in their understanding of Scripture and in the Reformed tradition. But we need your help in order to continue making more resources and expanding our offerings and distributing them around the world. So please visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate. To pledge your support today. I want to thank everybody who does support us and everybody who's considering it. We also want people to know about our Reformed Theology Conference coming up in the fall. We have our second annual Reformed Theology Conference, October 16th through 18th, held at Hope OPC in Grays Lake, Illinois, which is just north of O'Hare Airport, about 20 to 30 minutes, depending on time of day and how fast you like to drive. But we are welcoming Tippin and Richard Gaffin, both professors, professor of systematic theology and professor emeritus of former New Testament, and then also of biblical and systematic theology, Dr. Gaffin, coming to speak about the Spirit and the Church, so the intersection of pneumatology and ecclesiology. And it's a very important subject. We're going to do some great work. We're going to hear some wonderful teaching and provide a wonderful opportunity for interaction. So we have 100 spaces, and many of those are taken. We have an early bird rate still in effect. And you can register online at reformedforum.org/conference. We want you to join us. We want you to be a part of this wonderful event, and we want you to participate. We want to learn and grow and speak about Reformed theology with you. So visit us October 16th through 18th, reformedforum.org/conference. Well, gentlemen, I'm very excited to speak today about the Huguenots and this important subject. But before we speak about the history, get into the name, get into the seedbed that was the France and Switzerland in the 16th century, Dr. Edgar, I want to give you an opportunity to introduce the Huguenot Fellowship and how it came about and what your current work is. What are the featured programs and labors that you undertake at the Huguenot Fellowship?
Thanks, Camden. Yeah, glad to do so. So the Huguenot Fellowship was founded by Edmund Clowney, James Boyce, and a couple of others in the mid-70s. Its central purpose was and is to support, by prayer and other resources, especially money, the Reformed Seminary in Aix-en-Provence. That seminary has had a fairly long history, but it was renewed and refounded in 1974. And it's really the only historically Reformed and evangelical graduate school in France. It's one of the rare ones in the world. So what we do, we've grown quite a bit since the early days. We fund various projects. I'll just mention three of them. One is a scholarship fund, which is named after Dr. Clowney. Even though education in Europe is generally either free or heavily funded, it's still expensive for students to be able to attend a place like Aix-en-Provence. Mm-hmm. So we provide a good scholarship fund for the needy students. Second, for a number of years since his departure, actually, we've been funding something called the James Montgomery Boyce Chair of Practical Theology. Mm-hmm. And so it's a fully funded faculty position. It is the practical theology position, which includes preaching, counseling, church planting, shepherding. And the current occupant is a marvelous man named Jean-Philippe Bru. Mm. And then a third project that I could mention is the post. They call it a post over there. We might call it just a position for apologetics. Mm-hmm. We and the Dutch split the cost of funding the chair of apologetics. We're not the only group that supports the seminary. There's a group of Dutch friends and some Swiss friends and, of course, many French. So those are some of the things that we do. We also go over there quite a bit. I travel there fairly regularly to share in the teaching. And some of them come over here. We've had events. We call them soirees, where we bring a professor over or a leading speaker to get people aware of our work and the work of the seminary in Aix. So that's the Huguenot Fellowship. The board has about 16, 17 members. As Dr. Boyce used to say, there's three W's always necessary for a board: work, wisdom, and wealth. We have a lot of work and wisdom. We don't have a lot of wealth, but through God's generosity, we've been able to raise significant monies over the years.
Praise
so
the Lord.
There you go.
Yeah, we know what you mean in terms of the nonprofit dynamics, and it's hard, but the Lord is good, and the supporters are good. So it's always a pleasure to hear about the labors. If people would like to hear more, they can listen into our archives to Christ the Center episode 196. And though it's a few years old, I'm still certain that it will be beneficial and fruitful for you to listen. Or you can hear an episode about Reformed theology in France. We spoke with Kim Tran and Yannick Imbert from the faculty Jean Cavan in Aix-en-Provence to speak about the history and the current state of Reformed theology in France. And Dr. Edgar's lovely wife, Barbara Edgar, who has taught many a seminary student in the ways of the French language. She offered some translation in that episode. So that is reformedforum.org/CTC196, and I'll put a link to that in the episode description. Now, Dr. Edgar, as we speak about Reformed theology and Reformed history and the Reformed tradition, we often speak about John Calvin, but we might not speak about his legacy and those who were heavily influenced by him, at least in the French-speaking world. The reasons for that, I'm not certain. Perhaps you have ideas and you can clue me in as to why that has fallen off. But in terms of the Huguenot history, can you speak to us a bit about the origins of the Huguenots, maybe what their name means and where they come from? Who are these figures and why are they important for the Reformed history?
Right. Well, France had its own Reformation. Some of it was dependent on Luther, mm-hmm. But some of it was independent of Luther. And the leading figures in it, people like Jacques Lefebvre d'Etaples, many others, discovered the beauties of the Reformed faith by translating the Bible into French. And so difficult was their position that they had to hide, and they were often persecuted because not only the Catholic Church, but the French government was in and out of cahoots with the Church, and they considered Protestantism a dangerous heresy. So the brightest light, of course, in that movement was John Calvin, Jean Calvin from Picardy. Mm-hmm. The details of his conversion are not certain, partly because he just didn't talk about it. There's a hint in one of his commentaries on the Psalms that he came from a mire, a murky past, into God's marvelous light. But it doesn't, unlike Luther, whose biography we know so well, we don't know his. What we do know, though, is his extraordinary writing. He had to flee. He fled to Geneva, wasn't intending to stay there for long. He wanted to lead the life of a quiet scholar. And the fiery, red-headed preacher from Gap in the Alps, another Frenchman, Guillaume Farel, mm-hmm. learned about Calvin being there and came and urged him to stay. Not sure that his principles of guidance were thoroughly biblical, but it was a very bad thunderstorm outside, and the lightning came very close. And he said something like, "The next one's for you if you don't stay." So Calvin, a very timid fellow, of course, he didn't stay because of fear. He sensed real responsibility. He had already written up a version of his Institutes, which is one of the great masterpieces of the 16th century. Mm. And he was known as a good debater. And they urged him to stay because the town wanted to become reformed, but they needed leadership. So mm-hmm. he actually became a pastor there, contrary to myth. He was not on the, you know, magistrate's office, or he wasn't the mayor, and he certainly wasn't a tyrant or a dictator. A lot of people don't realize that Calvin didn't always get his way by any means in the city's affairs. He had views, and he let them be known, and there was church discipline, but the town council didn't always agree with him. So difficult was it at first that he was actually kicked out of the place after only being there a few years. So he went to Strasbourg, which he loved. But then one of the Catholic bishops, Sadoleto, wrote a letter to Geneva urging them to come back to the Mother Church. And they just didn't know how to answer this, so they urged Calvin to answer the letter and then urged him to come back, which he graciously did. And he stayed there the rest of his life. So the Reformed movement in France was homegrown and also very influenced by Luther, as one could expect. And a lot of people forget the homegrown part of it. Some scholars note that Luther's writings were all over the place, and there were. But there were a number of remarkable men and women who stood in the Reformed faith with great courage and left us a great legacy. Even the French people, you asked me why he's kind of forgotten. Even French people, until a few years ago when they celebrated the 500th anniversary of his birth, had kind of forgotten that John Calvin was a Frenchman. Mm-hmm. You know, I've gotten graduate papers here where it says John Calvin, the Swiss reformer. Well, he wasn't Swiss. But anyway, and then they, to their delight, discovered him as a remarkable figure, a genius. And I mean, not always for the right reasons, but they see the Protestants today as standing up for human rights and independence of thought. And so they rehabilitated Jean Calvin, so much so that our little seminary in Aix-en-Provence decided to change its name to the Faculté Jean Calvin. It had had another name before. So this whole rise of this movement owes a great deal to Calvin, but also to other French people. Now, you asked about the name.
Mm.
And the simple answer is that nobody knows. There's a couple of guesses. The best one, in my judgment, is that it comes from a Swiss-German word.
Right. It's kind of a pun.
Eidgenossen. And Eidgenossen means something like federated ones. It probably referred to something like small groups or house churches or Bible studies. And for some reason, it just stuck and it morphed into Huguenot. It's a word that has, you know, no meaning other than that possible Swiss-Dutch, Swiss-Patois connection.
Yeah.
And so, but it's stuck and it caught on. And now, you know, anyone who has a Huguenot background, it's a point of pride. Not that the Huguenots would have favored that, but there's a branch of French Protestants who are historically linked to the Huguenots, and they consider themselves, I mean, it's like 1 Corinthians, you know, I'm of Apollos, I'm of Paul, and so forth. It's really not in the spirit of the thing, but it's still a very noble tradition, one of great suffering and one of great contributions to the Reformed faith, and to more than that, to political thinking, to business practices, to the arts, and so on. So that's what we think the Huguenots mean.
Yeah, there may be also, you know, I've heard possibly some connections with a Swiss politician. My pronunciation is going to be atrocious, but Besançon Hughes, or Hugues, who possibly they might have made some sort of pun by combining his name with the German Eidgenosse. You know, who knows?
Yeah.
Some of the history is there and is confusing. But the connection to a politician might be interesting. What kind of political factors were involved in France and Switzerland in the 16th century, and what did that mean for Protestants?
Yeah, well, France was a very centralized country. And the king, François Premier, Francis I, at the beginning was rather sympathetic to the Protestants. He had family members who urged him to be sympathetic because they belonged to the Reformed faith. But through a series of unfortunate incidents, he changed his mind. One of them is called the Placard Affair. And a placard was a poster that somebody wrote. We're not sure who. It could have been Calvin's cousin, Kopp. Anyway, denouncing the Mass as a fiendish heresy and the Pope as a corrupt man and so forth. And they plastered these things all over Paris, including on the king's bedroom door. So not the most tactful way to push your message. So for that reason and many others, the Huguenots were out of favor. And the church, of course, was very angry with them because they challenged their authority. And unlike some countries, Germany, Holland, England eventually, and of course our own, the acceptance of the Reformation in France didn't come until the 19th century, mostly thanks to the French Revolution, not because of convictions. So it was very difficult for France. Switzerland is a bit different. As you know, Switzerland wasn't really a country. It was a loosely held federation of states, cantons they're called.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the most powerful was Bern. And Bern became Protestant and was able to help other cities who wanted to become Protestant to do so. Now, to become a Protestant city did mean you had to renounce the authority of the Catholic Church, the local bishop, the Mass had to be repudiated, and in its place you put the doctrines of the faith, the Reformed faith, in the forms of catechisms and confessions and so on. Some of that transition was understandably violent. Violent because of the opposition, on the one hand, and then violent because of the practice of iconoclasm, on the other. So opposition, for example, to Geneva was by the Dukes of Savoy, who were allied with the powerful local bishops in the Savoie area of France, which is what surrounds the city of Geneva. And several attempts were made to recapture Geneva by force. None of them succeeded, and Geneva is very proud of its ability to have resisted these forces. But to answer your question about the politics, becoming a Protestant, unlike our day, was not just an individual matter, not just an option that is acceptable under the Constitution and so forth. It was a challenge to the existing institutions and laws. And so there was often a lot of friction. in that challenge. And several cities in what we call Switzerland became Protestant, and for some of them it was violent, some of it was not. Iconoclasm is the practice of literally destroying images. We might, with our hindsight, think, you know, that not very sensitive about the arts. And maybe sometimes people went a little hard and fast, but
yeah.
I think we need to understand that these weren't artistic objects primarily. These were objects of worship. Mm-hmm. They called it veneration, but the distinction was lost on most people between veneration and worship. And so taking down statues and paintings and things like that, indeed sometimes violently and without sort of storing them in museums, was another statement of the coming of the Reformed faith. So, yeah, those are some of the conditions. There are a lot of others I could mention, but those are the primary ones where you can expect political opposition, institutional change, and a great deal of just tension and friction.
Now, one thing that often comes up when you speak about the Huguenot history is their relationship to the state and to those in power. And there are a lot of questions about religious persecution and religious freedom. There are many significant events that have happened as well, including a series of religious conflicts that were known as the Wars of Religion, and they eventually ended with the Edict of Nantes. What were those fights and those wars primarily about, and what was eventually granted to the Huguenot cause afterward?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, as you are, as you surmise, there are waves of persecution. There was times of relative peace, and then times of great hardship. And in the 16th century, one of the culminations of the hard times was in what is now called the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre, and that was in 1572, if I'm not mistaken. I don't have this stuff in front of me. But what happened is probably a plot to get the country rid of Huguenots. And it may have been a plot approved by Catherine de' Medici, who was standing in for the king who was too young to rule. She was a diplomat of sorts and tried to make things work, but it wasn't going to work. Therefore, things came to a head. It started in Paris, and then it spread all over the country. And one of the great losses of the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre was Coligny, who was an admiral and a leader of the Huguenots. You know, some of the military actually became Protestant, and he was one, and he was a famous warrior, much respected. But this was a very bloody time. Literally hundreds of thousands of people were killed throughout the country. Eventually some peace came, but then beginning very soon, as you mentioned, there were the wars of religion, as we call them. Now, again, going back to what we said earlier, being a Protestant meant political commitments as well as spiritual ones. Same with being a Catholic. And so most often these wars were by Protestant countries or areas against Catholic countries or areas. And there were seven or eight of them, and then some minor ones that lasted a number of decades. Finally, as you rightly say, King Henry IV, the first Protestant king of France, who sadly to me converted back to Catholicism because he thought it was politically savvy. Nevertheless, wrote a piece of legislation that was a compromise for the sake of peace. The Edict of Nantes provided six, I believe it was, areas where Protestants could be free to worship, to marry without the bishop, or the priest, to educate their children in the faith in their own schools and to read the Bible at home and that sort of thing. Protestants welcomed it, although it wasn't quite as good as they would have liked. These areas were heavily controlled. They were limited. They weren't allowed to call their own synods. So there were limitations, but it was at least a concession, a step towards freedom. That freedom was enjoyed for nearly a century. The edict was penned in 1598, but then in the 17th century, things really began to go wrong. Lots of theories as to why, including some French historians believe that the Protestants got too prosperous and careless. Others, they got themselves into controversies that were minor instead of major. Others that the both the king and the Catholic Church wisely were able to parcel them off and divide and conquer and so forth. So that towards the end of the 17th century, King Louis XIV, who's known as the Sun King, but was no friend of the Huguenots, was convinced by his ministers that the Huguenots had pretty much been wiped out.
Wow.
There's one or two left maybe, but not to worry about them. So he penned the Edict of Fontainebleau, which revoked the Edict of Nantes. Uh-huh. And not only did it revoke the Edict of Nantes, but it gave any remaining Protestants 3 weeks in which to recant of the what they called the pretended reformed religion. la religion prétendue réformée, known as the RPR. Would they not do so, the men were subject to heavy sanctions, including being sent as slaves to row on the king's galleys. And the women were put in prison, like Marie Durand, who was put for 38 years into the Tower of Constance and survived, thanks to God's grace, and is famous because she led the other women in Bible studies and prayers and psalm singing and so forth, and carved in large letters on the cistern in the middle of the prison, résister, resist. And of course, a lot of people today think, wow, that's what a Protestant does. He resists. And it's all, you know, that's how modern of us. She didn't mean that. She meant Protestant in the sense of protest, resist from a position of strength because the gates of hell cannot prevail against the church. So this ushered in the most terrible period of time. There were many more than a handful of Protestants left. They call it the period of the desert or the wilderness. And again, for nearly a century, the 18th century, Protestants had to go into hiding. You can visit museums in the Cévennes Mountains where you can see sort of the false floors and the false attics where they would hide when the king would send his dragoons in to inspect the house. Sometimes they would quarter in the houses because they knew that they were Protestant, and they would take advantage of the women, and it was just an awful period. Again, they survived thanks to God's providence and to remarkable leaders who felt a call to pastoral ministry, who would go to Geneva or Lausanne to train. And when they were finished, the diploma that they got was known as the Diploma of Death, because going back to France meant sure persecution and likely death. Antoine Court was one of them. And so they kept the church alive by preaching and teaching, although it emerged after this period, as I mentioned, because of the French Revolution, very battered and worn out and torn. And then the story of their recovery and how they got to today is another one. But that's the brief history of the Huguenots. Waves of persecution, some periods of peace. Many of them fled to other countries who welcomed them because of their talents and because of religious toleration. Switzerland is one place, parts of Germany, Holland, England and America. My ancestors happened to be Huguenots who fled during the persecutions to South and then North Carolina. So it's a remarkable story of you know, as Tertullian might have said, the blood of the martyrs being the seed of the church, because they brought amazing gifts wherever they went. A lot of this country, America, owes institutions and cultural things, and even the design of the city of Washington to French Huguenots. Paul Revere, you know, who helped against the British, was a Huguenot. So they impoverished France. One of the dumbest things France could ever have done was to persecute their Protestants. It's on the level of Germany persecuting their Jews, you know. That's like a suicidal move, but they did it, and France has never quite recovered and been in the same league as many other countries where there was toleration.
Dr. Edgar, that maybe this is a good time for me to ask this question, because you're kind of led right up to it. For Christians today, particularly for Christians who are not familiar with the Huguenots, perhaps even those among the pretended Reform religion, what, you know, I suppose, especially regarding the Huguenot heritage of persecution and their response to that, just sort of as a pastoral question, what lessons do you think we need to learn from the Huguenots and their response to that persecution?
Yeah, what a wonderful question. I've just been reading a great book by Gary Williams, who's the principal at the John Owen Center in London. And it's called Silent Witnesses. And he has a chapter on some of the great heroes and heroines of the faith. And he introduces us to various Christian doctrines by through the lives of, you know, Owen and Edwards and Luther and many, many other people. And I think if we could learn from these heroes more directly through their biography, that is one way to be inspired. Let me just give you a sample of this. Of course, the greatest of all the reformers was John Calvin. And he's easy to caricature because he's such a great man, and great people, great leaders often suffer from caricature. I had a professor where I went to college. I took the course in Reformation studies, and he said, "Calvin is the greatest genius I've ever encountered, and I hate everything he stood for." So, you know, it was so true of so many people. They recognize his genius. We ought to recognize not so much his genius, but his guidance. Where are the special places, you know, where we can go to Calvin over and over again? Of course, his extraordinary theology, his high view of scripture, you know, it was a rare thing until his time to actually base an entire treatise or a book with scriptural references alone. Well, he's very familiar with the church fathers, of course, as well, but it's scriptural. His approach to relating to God through faith, not only faith alone, but to a faith that doesn't sneak works back into the mixture. As you remember, his controversy with Sadoleto was about these issues. And Sadoleto agreed, oddly, that justification was by faith alone. That was no problem for him. But when you ask him what he means by faith, it becomes a kind of human meritorious response. So he sneaks works back into it. And I think Calvin, he corrects this beautifully and takes away all pretext of merit. I've never read anyone who is quite so anxious to get rid of merit. He even in his in book two, where he's talking about free will, he says, "Well, I guess we have to use that expression because the fathers use it, but I don't like it because it sounds like we bring something into the mix." But then, magnificently, he says, "But that faith is not alone because it comes with sanctification. Justification is by faith alone, but justification doesn't come by itself. It leads to sanctification." And as you know, in the Institutes, he sandwiches the chapter on justification by two on sanctification. And some people have said, well, he's a Protestant. Why is he doing that? Why doesn't he just start with justification? I think the reason is he was so concerned with godliness, the mortification of sin and so forth. And finally, what you learn from Calvin is how to endure suffering. This poor man, he was never well. He was never unopposed. I think Gary Williams says somewhere, a lot of us wish we could be in Geneva at the time of Calvin and see everything unfolding before us. And then he says, Calvin would have said, stay away. You'll hate this. It's so full of opposition and corruption and persecution. It's just not a pretty place. He, more than most, guides us through suffering. This dear man, he met his wife while he was in Strasbourg in exile. And they came back to live in Geneva, and they had a child. The child died a few months after he was born. And Idelette, his wife, died 9 years after they were married. And he wrote these moving pages on the grief that he suffered, and God had taken away his best friend and all these things. And then he's resigned to it because he believes in the goodness of God. So that's, I think, just one of the Huguenots can teach us such a lesson, in scriptural authority, a lesson in justification, godliness, suffering, a boldness that all of us should have. None of us will be Calvins, but we can all share in when we really understand that God has loved us and bought us at a great price, that the atonement was effectual, then it should just lead us to be very bold in our faith and in our own, not just resistance, but the proclamation of it. Mm. So many other lessons, but those are some of them.
Oh, that's wonderful. And maybe just two follow-up questions on that. So, I appreciate you mentioning the need. This is a need, pastoral need I'm trying to express to folks in our church, the need to read more Christian biography.
Yes.
So that is helpful. What other works, either regarding Huguenots or perhaps even by Huguenots, and I'm guessing those would need to be ones translated into English, besides Calvin, would you recommend? Are there works by Lefebvre or others that you would recommend?
Yeah, that's a really great question. Just off the top of my head, I'd have to dig back and look. There are, sadly, not as well known, but there are published works by these other reformers. Farel wrote, his sermons were published. He's been written about as well. Lefebvre is just being rediscovered because it was an anniversary of his just last year, I think. Mm. And he wrote marvelous commentaries and things like that. Marie Durand, I mentioned her as the lady put in the Tower of Constance. She left us quite a long correspondence. Hmm. Now, it's not translated, but it's a beautiful, because letters were allowed to go in and out of these prisons, unlike, let's say, the Gulag, where it was much harder, and certainly unlike the Nazi concentration camps. These letters were not necessarily censored, and they're gems of edification. And then there's just standard histories, various ones at various levels, some of them popular, some of them much more technical. I'd have to remember. Émile Léonard is probably the very, very best, and I believe it's been translated into English. Mm. But standard books on the Reformation, the better ones will have good chapters on the Huguenots. You know, McCullough and McGrath, and just some of the great books on the Reformation always would include some chapters on the Huguenots. So there's a lot more available there than at first you might think. And I agree with you. It's very important that Christians read more biographies. You learn from the good ones. You just learn so much, and especially ones where the biographer is sensitive to theology and not just writing the story of a great person.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful.
I know Dr. Truman signs William Estep's book, The European Reformations, in his History of the Reformation class, and that has an extended chapter on the Reformation in France and a wonderful treatment of the Huguenot cause. And I know I've grown from that quite a bit, and he treats in more detail. It's a textbook format, but he treats in more detail some sections of the Reformation that are frequently overlooked.
Yeah.
There's so many out there that are really good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That may be one of the very best, but there's others too.
Yes.
Osment, his work is mostly on the German side, but he has a extensive treatment of the Huguenots. Yeah. There's many, many others, but, if your listeners would like, I'd be glad to suggest.
Well, be careful what you offer.
Well, I'll do it through your.
We can work something out. Put something, if people are interested, you can always email us or put something in the comment thread, and we can connect you with Dr. Edgar or work on a bibliography of sorts and pass that along. There's such a rich history and tradition here, and it's really been exciting to connect this to some modern day causes. And you know, just speaking more of modern times, you mentioned a while ago the French, not the French Reformation, but the French Revolution. And, you know, what effects did that have on stifling, you know, the Protestant cause or causing issues for centuries to come? And do you see any modern day applications, at least in France, or modern day parallels that we might learn from the Huguenots and the persecution that they endured?
Well, let me give you the thesis. I'm not sure who originated it. It might have been Macaulay, but it's been reiterated by a number of historians that those countries that embraced the Reformation as a whole or in part moved into modernity with discussion, parliamentary disputes, changing of laws, and so forth.
Rather than violence.
So those countries that did not embrace the Reformation came into modernity violently. Italy, France, Russia, and so forth. I think so on the negative side, the French Revolution stands for a violent shift into modernity, which was never fully, I don't think that violence has ever fully been absent. Even in France, there were minor revolutions throughout the 19th centuries. And even today, France is divided roughly into liberals and conservatives or revolutionaries and those who would stand more in the tradition of institutions. And, you know, the French Revolution at one point violently overthrew the traditionalists. But they came back early on and gained power through the monarchy and through lots of other things. And that tug of war, it's always present in France. Now, ironically, the French Revolution was more of a help than a hindrance to the Protestants. I say ironically because it meant to be anti-clerical, and it was, and you know, churches were destroyed and ministers deposed and so forth. But Protestants actually believed in the principle of secularization. The word secular, we use it today to mean, you know, irreligious or something like that. But what they meant was a separation of church and state. And when Napoleon took the reins right at the end of the revolution, he wrote some laws that ensured the freedom of Protestants and Jews, and of course Catholics, freedom to have their own schools, their own places of worship, and so forth. It was a great step forward in modern liberty of assembly, liberty of speech, and so on. So oddly, the Protestants actually gained a fair amount from the French Revolution, so much so that they rather foolishly gave over many of their schools to the state on the assumption that, well, as long as it's not Catholic, it's going to be fine. And of course, a century later, the state intruded heavily into the schools. And today, there's a principle called laïcité, which means literally lay state, as in layman, where you may not teach religion in the classroom. You may not wear a veil in a public place. You may not have your, you know, Sunday school meeting in a schoolroom. So what was at first quite a gain is now, of course, a concession to state power that never needed to happen.
Yeah.
Hmm. Dr. Edgar, I have a question for you. It may or may not be one that you've thought explicitly about. But you know, I know your bread and butter, so to speak, is apologetics, teaching and practicing apologetics. You know, has your study and your involvement with the Huguenots, how or has that, you know, affected your teaching, practicing apologetics? Are there connections there or lessons to be learned?
Oh, my. Many, many. Yeah, that's a great question. There are direct ones. So I teach in a tradition sometimes known as presuppositional, and we're trying to change the name to covenantal.
Right.
I think that's a better name. I don't know. Names are names. But many of the principles that we use go directly back to some of the Huguenot ancestors. You know, Calvin's view of sin, and then, you know, later to be called total depravity. And that is one of the principles that we recognize when we're embarking in Christian apologetics that refuses to make concessions to the ground on which unbelievers stand. Also, of course, one of the common problems that we face is often called the problem of evil or suffering. And again, my love of my ancestors and remembering of how much it cost them to give us the freedom we have, especially in the 18th century, is a direct help in the whole area of dealing with the problem of evil. You know, the famous line in Genesis, "You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good." Mm. And then there's indirect links as well. I think one of the great achievements of the Genevan branch of the Reformation was the beginning steps of a good and healthy separation between church and state. The first Reformed Synod in 1559, and it's the form of church government that it espoused, were some important steps towards the modern way in which a church is not dependent on a government for certain things while it respects the government for others. That separation of the spheres is very helpful in apologetics, particularly as you're dealing with Muslim unbelief. because Islam, among other things, is a theocracy kind of religion.
Yeah.
And there's really no separation of, you know, quote unquote, church and state. And so the Huguenots teach us that that's a desirable thing. It doesn't mean the state has to be irreligious. That wouldn't have been their idea at all. It would have been that the state has to apply biblical principles as it enacts justice and fairness and rewards righteousness. Sadly, of course, many people, when they hear about separation of church and state, they think the state has to be completely secular in the irreligious sense. That's not at all what our ancestors taught us. Yeah. So that's another connection with apologetics. And then finally, you know, the art of persuasion. These extraordinary Huguenots, and they were not the only ones, but they were amazing debaters. They could take major issues and find the fine points where they differ with other faiths or other belief systems. You know, for example, Sadoleto and Calvin on justification. You know, Calvin even agrees. I don't know if you know this letter. It's a very famous letter. Sadoleto says, you know, we're all going to face the judgment. And what's going to matter is, are you justified by Jesus Christ when you get there? And Calvin says, yep, that's the issue. I accept those terms of the debate. No, now that's a very smart thing. You don't always accept the terms of your opponent's debate because sometimes the playing field isn't level. But he said, yep, that's exactly right. Now, let me show you why your view of justification won't get you there. So, you know, you just admire the art of persuasion. You know, and there's so many other great models in this. Pascal, who was not a Protestant, obviously, but was close to the Augustinian background of the Protestants through something called the Jansenist movement. He was one of the finest persuaders of his generation. And so I think that's another lesson you can learn for apologetics, just the art of persuasion, especially when the opposition can be hostile. You know, 1 Peter 3:15, the locus classicus, for my discipline,
yes,
you know, tells us to be ready when people ask you the reasons for the hope that you have. Well, they're not just asking you, what do you think? This is an interesting discussion. It's a hostile question, and at least for First Peter. And knowing how to treat them, lift up Christ in your heart and treat them gently but firmly, I think that's a lesson for any apologetics from any tradition. But the Huguenots have helped us in an enormous way to do that.
You know, another one of those key apologetic sections in the Bible is Acts chapter 17, where Paul goes to Mars Hill to speak to the public intellectuals or the philosophers who like to speak about things that were new, and they invited him there because he was so strange and unusual. And when you speak about French philosophy and French the French intellectual tradition, we can't but help think about a lot of the cafes on the banks of the River Seine and all of the wonderful conversations that no doubt went on there in the 19th and 20th centuries, especially in the 50s and 60s. I can't help but ask, I know that we shouldn't be about just trying to make Christianity an intellectual curiosity. It's God's truth, which is what we need for life and for practice and in order that we might glorify and enjoy him forever. But at the same time, do you think French Protestant ideas or even the Huguenot tradition was ever discussed among some of the great French philosophers of recent vintage? And if not, how might Christians change that into the future so that we are engaging, you know, speaking particularly about the French climate, intellectual climate, but how might we change that for the future so that we are engaging with the ideas of the day and speaking God's truth into the world and defending the faith in a way that's appropriate to 1 Peter 3:15 and Acts 17, for example?
Yeah, well, I love your reference to the French cafes. I've spent more than my share of time in them. One sad negative example is Jean-Paul Sartre.
Yeah.
He developed a lot of his philosophy in a couple of cafes on the left bank.
The Dôme is one of them? Or?
Well, he was, yeah, Les Deux Magots.
Les Deux Magots.
Okay. And Flore were the two major ones. And did you know he was a Protestant? You know, his uncle was Schweitzer. I mean, he has a long, noble Protestant heritage, but he became an atheist.
Yeah, it nauseates me.
I hope the listeners get this.
I'm sorry.
Literary reference.
Yeah. The joke may nauseate others, I think.
Yeah. interesting you should ask that, because there's a movement afoot. It's about 10 years old, called Philosophical Cafes.
Really?
Yeah. It's mostly in Paris, but they're starting to do it in the regions as well. And only in France, I think, would this work. But you go to a cafe knowing that there's going to be a leading philosopher there who will entertain your questions, enter into dialogue with you. You know, now, no telling what kind of philosophy he's going to teach.
Sure.
But that's considered an evening's entertainment, to go to a cafe and listen to a philosopher. Well, yeah, Christians have gotten into on the act a little slowly, but what a perfect thing for a Christian to do is have a Christian philosophical cafe. And, so there are those. And there are other ways in which French people are, instead of bringing people to church, which doesn't always work in France because of bad connotations, as it were, bringing the church to them. I mean, eventually you're all supposed to go to church, but there are many occasions where people have brought the gospel into the business world or the art world or the theater or all kinds of places where you wouldn't think it would have its place, but of course we know it does. So there's a couple of significant arts centers in Paris and one in Marseille where they put on plays and poetry reading and give lessons in sculpture and so forth, all from a gospel orientation. And they're having a tremendous effect in bringing French people to the gospel. One final anecdote that you probably know about, Albert Camus, who is such a hero to many, including myself.
Author of The Stranger. Right?
Author of The Stranger, The Plague. Mm-hmm. The Fall, and a very attractive person, because unlike Sartre, he wasn't a consistent atheist. In fact, it's not certain that he was an atheist, and he was very human, and so became one of the great voices for post-war modern France. Well, he went to the American Church on the Seine to an organ concert to hear the great Marcel Dupré. But then when the ceremony, the concert was over, he grabbed the minister, American Methodist minister, and said, "The real reason I came is I'm desperate to talk to someone like you about the Christian faith." And they went out. He said, "I won't do this if you're going to tell anybody else about it. It'll be off." But they went out to a couple of restaurants for a series of weeks. And at least one or two books that I've read believe that in these conversations, Camus pretty much took a step of faith towards the kingdom.
Wow.
I mean, we'll find out, won't we? But this is a remarkable story. I mean, all his life he struggled with whether it was true or not. And he had friends who were priests and so on. But this was... just an example of what you're saying, bring the church to the guy over a meal and just talk. And that's a tremendous model for apologetics. It's not the only way to do it. I'm a very classical. I believe in preaching from the pulpit, but there are other ways to do this as well. I think you think of, we all love the testimony of Rosaria Butterfield.
Mm-hmm.
She responded. She was this lesbian feminist in Syracuse, and she wrote an article, and a Reformed Presbyterian minister wrote a very thoughtful letter to her saying, I'd like to know more about your views and I'd like to know what your assumptions are and so forth. Would you care to come and have a meal with my family? And she said, yes. You know, 2 years later, after conversation after conversation, she not only became a Christian, but she married a Reformed Presbyterian minister and homeschools her kids.
Yeah.
I mean, this is just an amazing. So, and she does go to church. I mean, but at first, I think the pastor was wise not to say, you know, come on, why don't you come visit our church? There are times when that's exactly the right strategy. It's never wrong to go to church, but there are times when you just have lengthy conversations in a so-called safe place. And, you know, our Huguenots knew all about how to do that.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Edgar, for joining us today. This has been another fascinating conversation, as they always are when we speak with you. But it's a wonderful reminder to many of us, but also I'm sure this was a wonderful introduction to others to the very subject of the history and the legacy of the Huguenots and the French Protestant movement. Thanks for joining us today. We appreciate your time.
Oh, it's good to be with you.
Yeah.
God bless you.
Yeah, praise the Lord. If people would like to find out more information, we'll begin with the Huguenot Fellowship. You can find them at HuguenotFellowship.org. Again, I'll have links to all these things in the episode description so that you can find them easily. Of course, Westminster Theological Seminary is online at WTS.edu. And you can find information about Dr. Edgar and some videos and audio recordings of his labors. And Adam is available online at providencepres.com, where you can find out information about Providence Presbyterian Church just outside of Houston, Texas. If you're in the area, please stop by. I'm sure Adam and would love to welcome you to his church. And and Adam, I'm no doubt would be maybe interested in beginning a philosophy jazz cafe someday. So if
that's
you,
right.
Or his lovely wife could play the piano while Adam entertains philosophical questions for inquirers to the Reformed faith. So I'll invest, a measly sum.
Yeah, we met while I was doing my degree in philosophy and her in jazz. So it should work out.
I'm there. And, of course, we're online at reformedforum.org. You can find out information about all of our programs as well as how to get in touch with us. You can email us at mail@reformedforum.org or tweet us @reformedforum. We want to thank everybody for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.